Oh yeah,
Love
let's do it.
Talk Radio.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Saturday. 365 days of motivation and personal empowerment just for you. It's your main man, Marvin Rome, and a crew coming to you live. We got Brother Nemo in the house. Y'all going to want to hear this one. And we're going to be talking about the struggle for independent African education. It's all coming up live. It's coming to you in just a minute. So there is no greater love than for self and kind. That's what we're promoting here. No better love than for yourself and your kind, loving your people, right? We have to, as African-Americans, first of all, welcome. As African-Americans, we have to get back to a place of understanding how important love for self is, love for community is, love for your brother, your fellow brother man. As Africans, we must learn how to reorient ourselves to a different ideology and a different psychology that takes us back to who we were in terms of humanity, right? I think in being in association and being in fellowship with this culture, we've lost the tenets of our humanity. And as we continue to turn the pages back and take steps back to reclaiming our humanity, we will understand how important it is to return back to the kindred and the fellowship and the kindness and the love and the devotion and the respect that is created when you have an element. There's some things that we just have to understand as we continue to move forward, right? Through the trauma and through the abuse of our experience and experiences, we have lost our compassion for one another. We have lost our brotherly love for one another, many of us. We have lost our humaneness and our kindness and our kind-heartedness because of the abusive culture, society that is structurally created for that to occur. Lost the kindness and the tenderheartedness that we need and the consideration for one another, man to woman, woman to man, boy to girl, and so on and so forth. That has been lost. It's been eroded because of our experience or experiences in a culture that is not created nor defined for us or by us. That lack of understanding in relationship, lack of understanding of our place in the world. We have to reclaim our identity as human beings. We have to reclaim our humanity. We have to understand the importance of qualities like sympathy and simple tolerance for one another. I step on your shoe, man. I ain't mean to do it. I love you, man. My bad. What's wrong with that? Do you have to lose your life? Think about how far we've eroded where we have to lose our lives because of a step on the shoe or misunderstanding versus being lynched by somebody that just didn't like you because of the color of your skin. Because we weren't doing that when we came from. You got to know where you came from. What about goodness? Good-heartedness in the community, one for another. Well, we're not robbing and stealing and killing each other. I'm not suggesting that we rob and steal and kill anybody, to be honest. But that good-heartedness and that gentleness and that understanding has been removed for something else at the grassroots level. Now, as we continue to penetrate this culture and begin to have the mindset of an integrated individual in a system that's not created for you, you begin to understand how things work a little better. So then we have this idea that we're better than each other. We have to remove that. We have to understand how to be gentle with each other. To women, women to men, but most of all with our children, because we are their leaders. We are our guides. And lastly, mercy, just grace and mercy, and simple grace and mercy for each other. That is the element that we need to have as we move forward or reclaim. in our communities and in our families. Let's just practice these simple ideas in our families and see what happens. Change will begin to happen. There is a beautiful concept called the laws of Maayat. If we would embrace those, that's what I was saying. But I'm just going back to humaneness and humanity, the beginning of it. And now for the tenets of the NAAEA. We're looking at, I'm combining today education and whatever are the other tenets. We need a political education that really gets us to look at our stance politically wherever we are. We have to have a political agenda. You have to have a political mindset and a political strong construct to be able to move through this culture, right? We're going to have to understand how education and politics work together. And then we're going to have a strong movement toward an economic education. I'm spelling peace. And once we get this economic education, we'll understand how politics and economics work together. And if we understand collaboration and working together, then it conforms into something different. So you have to have a political and an economic education and platforms that we work under, right, together, collectively, right? We all have to be in the same group or the same organization. We can all be siloed and still work together, but we have to have a uniform consciousness. Next is the A. It's the individual one now. Once you get athletics, health, wellness, fitness, nutrition, mental health, physical health, and emotional health as a primary concern for you, that educational piece, educate yourself on the benefits of having health and wellness as a part of your daily practice. That education goes far because you have to be able to take care of your health. Your health is your wealth. Now, culture. A cultural education that links your current history and your experiences with your ancient and your past histories and the experiences that we have had that can lead us, that can be a roadmap or a blueprint for behavior, for actions, for relationship, and so on and so forth. And lastly, it's a comprehensive education, right? So you put education and education together, you continue to learn. And we have to continue to learn to be the best that we can be each day, every day, and one day at a time, because the work belongs to us. And now for the Stan McAnally moment. I'll be right back.
Stan, the deck is packed today. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
Yeah, man, we got the deck.
I just love it when you're able to explain the pillars of the National African American Empowerment Association. You know, when we have institutions that define our own reality, quit trying to get in to fit in. This is where it's at, and this is what we're doing.
That's right, brothers and sisters. Brother Stan is not with us, but those words, if you let them penetrate your heart, you'll understand what he means. Those tenets are very powerful, and we have to be effective at navigating and managing structures. When we get that part down, oh, we're on our way. If you do your history and go back to our people at the point that slavery ended and the work that we did between the end of slavery and Reconstruction, just go look at it. It speaks for itself. We're going to have to understand how important that is, and that's a tribute to my brother Stan Macklin, who did it so well for so long. He's gone, but he's not forgotten. Love you, brother. All right, now, favorite portion of the show, y'all know it's the Willie Lynch and Kwanzaa segment with my brother George. Brother George, come on, bring it. Let's rock with me today. Here he comes. There he is. Oh, yeah.
Bring it. What?
I see you, brother George. Brother George, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yes, sir. I'm doing fine, brother. I'm trying to do a little bit of moving today, but nevertheless, we're still going to make it happen. So am I
congratulations, brother.
All right, well, thank you.
I'd like to tell the audience that Brother George has done a remarkable job at being a great man. Keep doing what you're doing, brother. I'm turning it over to you. What you got for us today?
Yes, sir. Today's Kwanzaa principle is umoja, which is umoja, which is unity. And unity is within our families, within our groups that we hang around together. Unity means a lot of things on different levels. And I think the most important factor is us unifying as a people, because we've been cursed by the Ma'afa, which is the enslavement period. And during that period, we were conditioned to hate ourselves. And so through that process, we have learned not to stick together. And so it's a hard process to break through. But Brother Marlana Karanga, he put together this concept of Kwanzaa and the seven principles and more to help us to move forward on that journey of unifying again. And so unity is the most powerful piece in the black man and woman's future if we're going to last and survive in this country or in this continent. And so I wanted to say that about unity. And to back that up, I wanted to give a statement as to why being unified means so much to our people. This is the Willie List statement. And this is a segment out of a book called Ruins of Empires by Count Vonnegut. An example of an important omission of this kind may be found on the 15th, 16th, and 17th pages of this volume, which may be appropriately referred to in this connection. It is there stated in describing the ancient kingdom of Ethiopia and the ruins of Thebes. Thebes was the portion of Egypt where the University of Luxor was built, and they called it different names. There are people now forgotten, discovered while others were yet barbarians, the elements of the arts and sciences, a race of men now rejected from society for their sable skin, black, and frizzled hair, kinky hair, founded on the study of the laws of nature, those civil and religious systems which still govern the universe, in which standard authorities are cited, seems to prove that the statement is substantially correct and that we are in reality ancient Ethiopians to the fervent imagination of the persecuted and despised Negro. Let me go back. To the fervent imagination of the persecuted and despised Negro for the various religious systems now so highly revered by the different branches of both Semitic and Aryan races. They're talking about the Arabs and people that's in the Middle East, that's with Islam, and the Aryans, the Europeans. And so they're saying they're indebted to us. And this was Count Vonnegut, who was a European writer, and he wrote many different books on the ancient world. And he was saying that black people put these things into usage. We thought of them, we put the systems together, and we made those systems workable for humankind. And that's what came out of us when we were unified, the beauty of that unity. So, Brother Marvin, if you have no further questions for me, or if you do have a question for me, it's back to you.
Thank you, my brother. Great segment. Of course, you know it's time for the empowerment question of the week, which is a simple one. What are some steps, basic steps that we can get to or step toward to regain our unity and to unify?
Well, I think that's what Brother Nemo is going to talk about today on a much greater extent, because he's exactly right. We do need to have the freedom of learning the things that we have contributed, a proper education, which is learning the things that we have contributed to the advancement of human civilization. And we need to learn those things. That proper education is necessary. And so I think that if we start learning, you know, what is considered a proper education meaning a deucere, to bring up out of the things that are within you and your DNA through questions and different things like that you respond to, and you begin to have the experience called education. And so we need to do this with our young children all the way up and, you know, raise them up the right way. And by the time they get to be teens and young adults and adults, they'll be thinking in the same way. And we'll work our way out of this mess that we're in right now. But that's my response, brother. I hope it answered your question.
You got it. Thank you, Brother George. I appreciate that. It's all about education, my people, my brothers, my sisters. We're going to have to re-educate ourselves, reorganize ourselves, reinvent ourselves, begin to pour into our people what they need to know and understand. That is our job. There's a system out there functioning that wants you to be dysfunctional. It's the system. And that system is not designed for us to want to be collectively effective. Then the status quo changes. So you have to reinvent yourself, reinvent your mind, but you're going to have to do the work. And that work is daily. It's a daily practice of centering yourself and getting your mental and your emotional together. You got to do it, brothers and sisters. This is our plea. Educate yourself. Become the best person that you can be today and every day. And it's all about you simply doing the work and doing that work that makes your life better, not only for yourself, but for generations to come. And that, my brothers and sisters, is where it's at. Let's get to it. Let's do the work. 845-277-9250 is the number to call. We've got Slido in effect today. That's 240-862-240-0862. Now, let's quickly go over to Brother Booker for being the one in his segment. Brother Booker.
Yes, sir, brother.
You know I got to bring you in right?
Yes, sir.
Come on. Let's do it. Oh, yeah. I love it. Come on. Hey, Mom. Hey, wife.
Bring it. What?
Right here. Coming right up in just a minute. Going nowhere. Right, we right here. Thank you for listening. Brother Booker, what you got for me in being the one?
Yes, sir. Brother, peace to you and to everybody that's within the sound of my voice. Hope everything is well and peace be unto you. You know, the characteristics and qualities of the one, right quick. We're down to number four this week, my brother. And the first one, of course, is honest with yourself. The one is honest with himself. Number two is the one loves himself. Number three, the one loves his people. And number four, today's quality of one is the one believes in himself. Now, believing in oneself is the answer to what we've already been talking about, coming together as a people.
Because if you believe in yourself, then you're going to do the best for your people. And that means coming together as a people. When we believe in ourselves, we won't make statements like, I talk to brothers and sisters all the time about how unity is the answer to all our problems in the black community. If we just come together as a people, it'll solve every problem that we have in our community. And every time, the brothers and sisters will say to me, Brother Booker, you're correct. That is the answer to our problem. But it'll never happen in our lifetimes. We'll never see us coming together as a people in this hell that we're living in as a people in our lifetimes. We must realize how stupid of a statement that is. So it shows you how what condition we are in as a people. To say that we know the answer to our problem is coming together as a people, but we will never see it in our lifetimes, tells you the condition that we are in as a people. We must believe in ourselves. We must understand that the greatness of our Creator, who we call God, Allah, Buddha, Jehovah, whatever we call Him, is in us. That's what being the one is all about. Be that one, find your Father, find the God in you. The one believes in himself. That's the key to our coming together as a people. And your brother George was just talking about it. How can we unite? We've got to keep emphasizing the things we're emphasizing, brother, on being the one. It's each individual. When we all see it as individuals, we will see it collectively. Because once I see it as myself, as the one, you see it, Brother George see it, everybody sees it, then we will come. What else are you going to do but come together as a people once you see it? Be the one. The one believes in himself. Thank you, my brother. That's what I got for you this week.
All right. Thank you, Brother Booker. We appreciate your segment. We appreciate all the good work that you continue to do in our community. Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
All right,
bro. Thank
let's get
you,
on over to Brother Nemo. All right, peace. All right, Brother Nemo is coming up, and the theme today of his lecture or discussion will be about the struggle for independent African education. We're on education, and we have to be able to understand the importance of education. I'm going to bring Brother Nemo in so y'all know I got to bring him in right. Here we go. Oh, yeah. Welcome, Brother Nemo. Oh, yeah. Come on. Bring it. Brother
Hello.
Nemo, welcome to
peace,
the show. How
peace,
are you, sir?
Peace. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great,
well.
Man. I'm looking so forward to it. Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right. Good. I'm looking so forward to hearing what you have to tell us about the struggle for independent African education. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and then get into your lecture, sir. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. Peace, everyone. My name is Nehemiah Ibrahim Sims, known in my community as Brother Nemo. I'm a Harlemite. I'm from Harlem. My maternal side is from Harlem. My three times great grandmother, Ruth Baird, who was born in 1898, upstate, moved into Harlem in the 1910s, and in the late 1910s actually. My great grandfather, John Dewey, actually signed up to fight in World War II in Harlem. He fought in Egypt and in Ethiopia. My great uncle, who was also born in Harlem, who his name is also John Dewey, he fought in the Vietnam War and was was burned by friendly fire, by napalm, by the United States napalm. So I'm a Harlemite. It's a little bit about my family lineage. On my father's side, I'm Jamaican. So on his maternal side, we are direct descendants of Maroons, the Jamaican Maroons. So that's just a little bit about my lineage. Professionally, I'm an educator, a student educator. I teach political science, English language arts, and social studies at the Zyax Institute, which is an independent homeschool program in Brownsville, Brooklyn. And I teach debate. I teach debate at Ember Middle School in Brooklyn. I also operate a tutoring practice. I started tutoring in 2020. And since then, I've tutored over 25 children ranging from the ages of 4 years old to 18. I'm part of a number of organizations here in New York. I sit on the board of directors at the Brownsville Heritage House. I am a youth organizer with the Research Institute, How Our Lives Link All Together, being trained in the non-traditional approach to criminal and social justice, which is a social framework developed by ex-Panthers Larry Lukman White and Eddie Kibaka Ellis on how to interpret what happens in our neighborhoods. I also sit on the Youth Advisory Board of the Ella Baker Institute. I am the Deputy Coordinator for the North American region of the Pan-African Federalist Movement, which is a campaign machine dedicated to the establishment of the United African States. And by the year 2030, the United African States by 2030. I'm also a part of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement under the leadership of Chairman Mali Yeshitela. So in a couple other organizations. So I try to stay involved. And so that's just a little bit about me. I'm also an initiate in the Shrine of Ma'at. I think African spirituality is very important. That's just a little bit about me, my lineage, the work that I do. And I'm 24. I'm 24 years old. Oh, I can't leave this out. I'm also a father. I'm a father, and I am a husband. I have a son. His name is Aten. He's 2 years old. And my wife is pregnant with our daughter, who's due September 11th. So my wife is due to give birth any day now. Thank you.
Congratulations, brother. You have a wealth of community experiences. But hopefully before you leave, I want you to tell our audience a little bit about your experience with Ma'at. That's what I would like for you to do if you can, after you get through your presentation, if you don't mind. So I'm turning it over to you. I just had to add that piece. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you. I want to give, before I begin my presentation, I want to give some thanks to this radio station, to this organization, for giving me a platform. I want to extend thanks to my ancestors and to the listening audience. So thank you. Okay, so let's move. So my presentation today is called The Struggle for Independent African Educational Institutions. And this struggle is a solidarity campaign. It's an active solidarity campaign being waged by organizers in three different cities, New York City, Baltimore, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. We're trying to do a couple things, which I will get into with this campaign. But first, you know, let's just talk a little bit about the necessity of African-centered schools. You know, there's a brother, his name is Paulo Freire. Excuse me if I'm not pronouncing his name correctly. But he wrote this book called The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And one of the most famous quotes from that book is, there is no revolution, there is no struggle without identity. And so also coming from the NPA, the Non-Traditional Approach to Criminal and Social Justice, we also understand that the state, in response to the Black Revolution, the African Revolution that was happening in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, all around the world, but particularly in the United States, in response to that revolution, not only did they assassinate our leaders, but they also went out of their way to affect the schools, right? Taking certain programs out of the schools, as if our schools were beneficial in the first place, right? As if we were getting something from the public schools in the first place. But they also went out of their way to take certain trade programs out of the schools. I'm not an advocate for public school. I'm not an advocate for the K-12 program. We understand that the United States public school system was funded by elitists, by corporatists, Carnegie, Rockefeller, and the crew and the gang, and their purpose for funding United States public school system was not to empower the average person, much less the average African in this country. They were looking to create workers to work in their factories. And so I just want to put a pin right there that the public school system is, from its inception, it is ill-equipped to yield the kind of results that we need to nation build. In fact, I would go so far as to argue that it's not just ill-equipped. It's not even, I guess, possible. It's impossible to get the results that we are looking for as nationalists from the public school system. You can't. And so I just want to put a pin there. African-centered education is very important. We can start a quote from the Carnegie Woodson from The Miseducation of the Negro. Carnegie Woodson says, no systematic effort towards change has been possible. For taught by the same economics, history, philosophy, literature, and religion, which have established the present code of morals, the Negro's mind has been brought under the control of his oppressor. He says, the problem of holding the Negro down, therefore, is easily solved. When you control a man's thinking, you do not have to worry about his actions. You do not have to tell him not to stand here or go yonder. He will find his, quote, proper place and will stay in it. You do not need to send him to the back door. He will go without being told. In fact, if there is no back door, he will cut one for his special benefit. His education makes it necessary. And so we have to understand that education is really a process. We think education is something that, you know, we send our kids to. It's a school we send our kids to. It's a building. It takes place in a building. And and they come back to us, and everything is peachy keen. We have to understand that education is a process of socialization. And what's more, the ancestor, Dr. Francis Crest Welsing, will tell us that education is one of the primary battlefields of white supremacy. And so if we are serious about nationalism, if we are serious about Pan-Africanism, if we are serious about all these isms and all these grand ideas and all these abstract ideas, we must take the first step. And that first step is control your child's socialization process. Because just think about it. You know, for the parents who are listening, just think about it. You know, it's kind of insane. And you know, it's not kind of insane. It is insane. Think about it. of the education process. You, for 30-something weeks, 30-odd weeks, out of a 52-week year, you send your children to a school, to a place where you have exercised little to no influence, little to no power. For 5 days, sometimes 6 days, because some schools have Saturday programs, for 5 days out of a 7-day week, you send your children to a place where you exert little to no influence. For 8 hours, sometimes it's up to 14 hours because there's after-school programs and there's before-school programs. You send your for 8 to 14 hours out of a 24-hour day, you send your African child to a school, to a place where you exert little to no influence. And in some cases, you know, they have this thing called free K. So we're not even talking about a K through 12 program anymore. What we're talking about is a wholesale indoctrination process geared towards the miseducation and underdevelopment of the African mind. And so if we are serious about nationalism, then it stands to reason that we must get serious about education. I think that's just very basic. So let's lay a basic foundation to walk on. If we're serious about nationalism and we're serious about these big ideas, then we have to get serious about education. And we have to understand the nature of education, which is education is not a one-hit wonder type thing. Education is a process where someone is molding, is shaping the values, the morals, the ethics, the limits of imagination, the ideas of a human being. It's a process of socialization. This is what we as parents have to understand. Let's move. Now, as African people, we are facing five major problems here in America. Miseducation, mass incarceration, gentrification, access to wealth, and what's that fourth one? Miseducation, mass incarceration, access to wealth, gentrification, and the fifth one eludes me. My point is that one of the major problems that we are facing in this country is miseducation. And if we are serious about being nationalists, I'm going to continue to say this because sometimes, we have to call the seriousness and the urgency of our people into question. And we constantly have to apply that pressure to that specific area because it can become dogmatic how we speak. We can throw these terms around and quote these books, but the urgency and the seriousness is not reflected in how we live our everyday lives. So I'm going to continue to say that. If we are serious about nationalism, then we must become serious about addressing the problems of miseducation because it's foundational. And so African-centered schools directly challenge two. This is what the data shows us, that African-centered schools directly challenge two of those five problems. African-centered schools directly challenge miseducation, and they directly challenge the school-to-prison pipeline, which feeds the mass incarceration, which, as we know, gives jobs to working class white people because the prisons aren't in the inner cities. Where are the prisons? Yeah. You know. That's not what we're talking about. Let's stay on education. That's a whole other thing that we could get into. Where are the prisons located and who's benefiting economically from these prisons? But African-centered schools directly challenge miseducation. Crime-generative factors are structurally embedded in Black communities. This is what the data tells us. These are statistics that detail the negative impact of standard American public schools on Black youth. And I'm also pulling from the National Coalition for Criminal and Social Justice. Our analysis demonstrated a direct connection between low-income, racially isolated, underserved communities and racism, racial profiling, financial and banking redlining, and underachieving schools and poor quality education. Another source tells us that almost exactly the same neighborhoods that had so many people of its prison, so many of its people in prison have the worst schools in the city. Another source tells us that you can accurately pinpoint the relationship between substandard performing schools and people in those neighborhoods who are going into the adult prison and juvenile justice systems at disproportionate numbers. Why? Why? This is because, as I said before, that education, which if we are determining the meaning of the word etymologically, means to rear up, that education is a process of socialization. And through the process, and through this socialization process, the human being is given a sense of purpose or lack thereof, is given a sense of identity or lack thereof, and is taught the world. And so it behooves us not just to take our children out of public schools. That's only half the battle, or maybe a third of it. I'll say a third. The other third is to enroll our children in African-centered programs. It's not enough just to take the kid out of a public school system. What are you going to do? What program are you going to put them into? You're going to put them into another Eurocentric program where the content is Eurocentric, where the methodology of teaching, the pedagogy is Eurocentric, where they have the kids sitting in a classroom for 8 to 10 hours. That's as counterproductive as putting them in a public school. No, we must resolve out of public school and putting them into we must resolve to taking our children out of public school and putting them in an African-centered program so that we can develop African children according to African ways of life. This is integral. Now, that's just two-thirds of the job. The third third is to support the African-centered institutions that already exist. See, and as a people, we must, especially, you know, I believe that everybody is revolutionary, especially African people. I just believe, as I understand, our existence in this country is contradictory to the nature in which this country was built, therefore rendering us inherently revolutionary. Now, you have people who are conscious of their revolutionary activity, and you have people who are unconscious of their revolutionary activity. I believe that we conscious revolutionaries, you know, we get a kick off of saying these big words and talking this language that we feel like other people can't understand. If we get a kick out of it, we get an adrenaline rush, right? But if we are really being honest, we fall into dogmatic thinking, and it's reflected in the way that we talk. You know, we say these things like, Black people have no infrastructure. Black people don't own anything. Which is completely untrue. If you really, you know, go through the data, it's not true. We might not have as much as other groups of people. That might be true. But to say that we are completely, we have nothing, that's just completely untrue. Now, what needs to happen, and I'll show this through the presentation, because this is not just a presentation. I'm not just on here giving a presentation. This is actually a call to action for those who are listening. What needs to happen is the conscious revolutionaries need to support the infrastructure that is already in existence and centralize the infrastructure, that existing infrastructure, so that we can get to the infrastructure that is non-existent. But to continue to say that black people don't have infrastructure in 2023 is just untrue, and it's a product of ineffective dogmatic thinking, which we have to get out of. We have infrastructure. It's just disorganized. We have organizations. They're just disorganized. Let's move. Polo Ferris says, without a sense of identity, there can be no real struggle. The agenda of this presentation is outlined into objectives. Then we get into our methodology that we're using to attack our objectives. Then I want to give you a review of the implementation, and then we'll reach some conclusions. And then that would be the end of the presentation. What I just did previously, I assume that there are some listeners who are not hip to the necessity of African-centered education. And so I just wanted to give I just wanted to lay a solid foundation as to why African-centered education is not just important, but it's an imperative. If we're serious about nation building, you cannot build a nation if you are not educating your children. Okay, so there are 7 points of this struggle. The first point is that this struggle aims to strengthen the existing infrastructure, the existing grassroots race-first infrastructure, in order to better address the non-existing grassroots race-first infrastructure. We need to start, in 2023, we need to start where we have ground. We need to start where we don't need to start at zero, because we're not at zero. Even if we're at one, which I don't think we're at one, but even if we are at one, it's better to start from one than it is to start from zero. We have grassroots race-first infrastructure. I know, because I work in them. I'm a part of them. And it's not just in New York City either. What needs to happen amongst the grassroots race first infrastructure is we need to centralize. You know, the unconscious revolutionaries, the conscious revolutionaries, the people who are hip to what's going on and who are not caught up in the quote-unquote matrix, right? What we like to do is we like to proselytize, and we like to evangelize the unconscious revolutionaries. But I have a question. How do we expect the unconscious revolutionaries to organize and the conscious revolutionaries haven't organized? That might say something about the people who believe themselves to be conscious revolutionaries. Maybe you're not as conscious as you think, because we can't even get along with the people who are already talking about their Pan-Africanists. The black people that put the Pan-Africanism and all these isms can't even get together. How do you expect to get to the black people who don't identify as such? And so the first point is that this struggle aims to strengthen the existing race-first grassroots infrastructure in order to better address the non-existing grassroots race-first infrastructure. The second point is that this struggle aims to continue the transformation and radicalization of our education sector through a mutual aid developmental agenda. We'll get more into that later. third point is that this struggle seeks to raise the awareness of the African working class as to the existence of independent African-centered institutions. Do you know why a lot of our people don't have their children in independent African education institutions? Do you know that it's not because our people are irredeemably ignorant? This trope that is pushed by the system, that black people are just these ignorant people who don't give a damn about their well-being. Do you know that that's not true? That's incorrect. But the reason why a lot of our people don't have their children in these schools is simply because the schools don't have a certain level of visibility. The schools don't have a certain level of visibility. The people don't know about the schools. The people aren't aware that these institutions exist. It's not that black people are ignorant beyond redemption. In fact, you know, I'm not even going to go there, but the third point is that this struggle seeks to raise the awareness of African working class people to the existence of African-centered institutions, African-centered educational institutions. The fourth point is that we are urging institutions and their leadership to centralize around a mutual aid developmental agenda. What does that mean? We will get into that later throughout the presentation. But that's a key point, a mutual aid developmental agenda, MAADA. The fifth point, this struggle seeks aims to analyze organization-centric strategies, right? You know, we all know those these people who gangbang their organizations. They traded in a certain flag for another flag. You know, you used to gangbang the street organizations, and now you read Message to the Black Man, or you read what is another conscious book that y'all read? You read Asada, or you read some Marcus Garvey, and you joined an organization, and now you're gangbanging your organization. That's organization centricity. Actually, it's not organization centricity. We just know those individuals. I recant that last statement. That is not organization centricity, right? We just know those individuals who just quote-unquote conscious, who have some analysis, and they are part of organizations, and they refuse to work with other organizations. It's usually the people that are in the seats of leadership. I don't want to say authority, because authority and leadership are different. So this struggle aims to analyze how organization-centered strategies, right? Strategies based around building an organization and issue-centered strategies create the conditions to build coalitions and united fronts. And so what we need is we need a balance between issue-centric strategies and organization-centered strategies. There is a certain point where organizations like a school, like a hospital, like a community defense institution need to turn inward and focus on building themselves. That's true. Also a point in time where multiple organizations need to come together and say, we're going to tackle this issue. We're going to unite around this issue, not unite around our organization or our organizational symbol or anything like that. Because in truth, what we need are coalitions and united fronts. And so we don't want to swap issue-centric strategies for – we don't want to swap organization-centric strategies for issue-centric strategies. We want to keep a balance between organization-centric strategies and issue-centric strategies in the view of developing united fronts and coalitions. Let's move. Number six, this struggle seeks to experiment with participatory grassroots leadership and other decentralized organizing methods as its main mobilization strategy in order to distribute authority and responsibility evenly. This is another thing that we run into, another problem, another antagonism that we run into in the development of our communities, okay? That the vertical organization of power, the hierarchical organization of power. I'm not saying that it's bad. I'm saying that we need a balance. We need a balance between vertical structures and horizontal structures. Okay? And participatory grassroots leadership is a method in which authority, leadership, responsibility, and accountability are not organized vertically. They're organized horizontally. So everyone in the structure has the same amount of accountability, has the same amount of authority, therefore the same access to leadership. And we ran into the same problem in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. You know, I'm from Harlem. I know the history. Audubon Ballroom. The Black Panthers. In fact, one of the programs that I'm in, we're on 135th in the YMCA, where Queen Mother Moore was organizing out of. And so we understand what happens when you build a movement with one or two or three or four people in the front. Or not even just in the front, but the weight of the movement is upheld by a handful of people. We learn those lessons. What did COINTELPRO say? COINTELPRO say, are we just going to get rid? We're just going to attack the leaders of the Black Panther Party. We're going to do mass arrests. We're going to assassinate their leaders. And the movement falls apart. We must learn from the lessons that it is not today. It is not about vertical organization. It must be about horizontal organization. Because the contradictions of this system, of this capitalist system, are about to implode. You know, when you see working class crackers attacking their establishment, January 4th or January 6th, where those poor white people attacked the Capitol. When you see something like that happening, you know that this system is about to implode under its own weight, because the white working class never, throughout history, the white working class usually align with the white bourgeoisie. When do we see the white working class attack the bourgeoisie and there's no revolution that's about to happen? And so we must learn from what happened in the 1950s and 60s and 70s that this system is about to implode under its own weight. And we at the bottom of it. We at the bottom of the pyramid. And so when the pyramid comes down, all of the debris is going to hit us. We must not build a personality-heavy movement this time. Not this time. Let's move. It seeks to place, and this the seventh point is that it seeks to place this, the responsibility of movement work and struggle back into the hands of young Africans. You know, I'm a part of a lot of organizations, and there are too many elders holding leadership positions in these organizations. There are too many elders holding leadership positions in these organizations. You should not, we'll laugh at the United States for having a senile Joe Biden and having a senile, what's the speaker's name? What's that speaker? I don't know the speaker of the House, Mitch McConnell, or is that his name? Mitch McConnell, I think his name is. You know, he froze up. These people are senile, and we'll laugh at them for having 80-year-olds and 70-year-olds and 90-year-olds in political office. And then when you look at our grassroots organizations, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. We must put young black people, young African people, in the driver's seat. And I'm not saying, you know, I'm an African. I believe in co-leadership between the African youth and the African elders. That is how you have a sustainable movement. But that's not what we have right now. We have an elder-heavy movement. We must follow what SMIC with Kwame Ture and SNCC did and said, we will not move without the students. We will not organize without the young people. Because that is how you have a sustainable movement. You know, I know for a fact that in the organization that I am a part of, you know how many elders have died and their transition has impeded the process, the effectiveness of the movement? That you have an 80-year-old in a leadership position and the elder transitions, and now we have to stop for 6 and 7 months to address the transition of power and the elder's transition and so on and so forth. We need young people in leadership positions. Let's move. Excuse me, I get a little passionate sometimes. I get my blood boils, so excuse me. The guiding frameworks of this campaign was having a neighborhood study, the idea that crime-generated factors are intentionally embedded into black communities to feed the prisons, which is neo-slavery. Direct positive action, the idea that communities develop through direct engagement of the people and youth-led confrontation of the ills of neighborhoods in order to build pointed coalitions. That you don't change, you don't cause social change behind a computer with a pen alone. You have to get out into the neighborhood and force change. Dialectical materialism, which emphasizes the importance of real-world conditions, present-time analysis, and the presence of contradictions within things. We must not fall into dogmatism and black nationalism, the idea that black people must control the institutions and economics and where they live. Let's move. The first strategic goal of this campaign, of this struggle, is to engage the grassroots African working class community with youth-led decentralized cadres. You know, I want to put a pause here for a second. I want to put a pause. You know, I was taught by a very wise elder that sometimes, a lot of times, most times, when you are organizing, the byproduct of your project is more important than the project itself. The processes that you have to take to realize your goal is more important than the goal itself. And that is the same attitude that we apply to this struggle. I also want to explain why we are saying that this is a struggle. You know, going back to dialectics, which is the science of contradictions, how social change is caused. We recognize a couple contradictions. One, you know, we recognize the contradiction between the conscious revolutionaries and the unconscious revolutionaries, or the antagonisms, like I said, I should say, between the conscious revolutionaries and the unconscious revolutionaries. We conscious revolutionaries want to go to our unconscious revolutionary brothers and sisters and evangelize and proselytize. But we're not even together. So that's the first one. The second one is we come with all these big abstract ideas like some college professors, and the people of these neighborhoods are saying, yo, we have material needs, man. And so we must like figure out a way to tie the abstract, the ideal, the revolutionary to the tangible, immediate, and some might even say reformist. We must marry those two in order to gain the trust, fidelity of the masses of our people who are unconscious revolutionaries. You know, we come with these big ideas. I'm a proponent of the United African States by the year 2030. How am I going to go to a to the average unconscious revolutionary brother on the street and tell him about the United African States? I can barely go to the conscious revolutionary and tell him about the United African States. The unconscious revolutionary is going to laugh in my face and say, "Yo, you are talking nonsense. Yo, we need schools, man. What you talking about? Yo, we need food. I got bills to pay. What you talking about?" Now, does that mean that the idea of the United African States, is that an incorrect idea? No, that's not what it necessarily means. It just means that we as conscious revolutionaries have to make sure that we are communicating with the unconscious revolutionaries in a way that they will take us serious. And we won't just sound like a bunch of mad scientists. Okay, let's move to the second strategic goal. So the first strategic goal is to engage the grassroots African working class community with youth-led decentralized cadres. The second goal is to raise $50,000 from the African working class for the stated institutions. And the third goal is to subsidize the stated institutions and urge them to develop a developmental mutual aid agenda. And the fourth goal, the fourth strategic goal, which will come as a byproduct of accomplishing the aforementioned goals, is to build coalition culture amongst grassroots organizations. And so, just to clarify, I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. We're going to engage the African working class, the everyday African person, and collect $50,000 from these people. Then we're going to use that $50,000 to subsidize institutions. And I'll let you know the institutions as we get along in the presentation. We're going to subsidize those institutions. And after we subsidize the institutions, we're going to say, the African people, 5,000 African people gave $10, which equals 50,000. And the African people say they want you to systematize an integration effort between your organizations. We want your organizations to systematically integrate. We're not talking about putting on a joint event for one day or 2 days. No. We want a systematic integration effort between institutions that are already built, full stop. And we will have it. Because the authority, and just really quickly to get into we'll call it political science, the legitimacy of the state. Well, let's talk about the legitimacy of the institution. The legitimacy of the state, when you're dealing in a republic, comes from the people. Give their consent to be governed. Right? But, and it, as it says in the United States Constitution, and if the people do not want to be governed, they have the right to overthrow the government. Now let's put that on a grassroots level. Let's apply that to us, because we can critique our oppressors' structures so much. Let's critique our structures. Institutional leaders and these organizational leaders, they're just leaders. They don't have any authority. The authority comes from the people. Just how the state's legitimacy comes from the governed. The government's legitimacy comes from the governed. The organization and the institution's legitimacy does not come from the leader, the quote unquote leader, or whoever is at the top of the power hierarchy. The true legitimacy authority comes from the bottom. Just put a pin there and clarify that. That the leaders of these institutions don't call nothing. They don't call nothing. They're managers. They manage. They don't own nothing. It's the people that own these institutions. And so let's act like it. And we're, full stop. So our fundraising goal is $50,000. Oh, let me back up. And, oh, yeah, let me answer that. Let me go for it. Excuse me. our fundraising goal is $50,000, a.k.a. $10 for 5,000 African people. This would be very simple to do. You know, if we went through corporate welfare, if we applied for a grant from Walmart, or we applied for a grant from Staples or some corporation, even if we went through philanthropy, that would be very easy. We could have $50,000. First of all, that's no money. We'd have $50,000 yesterday. But that's not what we want to do. We need to engage the African working class, the quote-unquote masses of our people, and let them know that they are the owners of authority. And in the absence of their awareness of the fact, these leaders of these institutions are tyrants, and they must take the authority back from these tyrants. And so that's why we are that's why we are organizing in this way. That's why we have not went to philanthropy. That's why we have not went to corporate welfare, because we want to take the money from the African working class and go to these quote-unquote Pan-African organizations and institutions and say, this is what the people say they want you to do. And they're going to ask us, well, how do you know what the people want you to do, want us to do? And we're going to show them that $50,000. And we're going to show them that those 5,000 signatures. And we'll see what Pan-African organizations will dare to defy the people. And we'll know that some of these organizations are not actually Pan-Africanists. Some of them are using Pan-Africanism because Pan-Africanism is a market. Black power is a market. But that's a different conversation. Let's move. The institutions receiving direct benefit are the Ziaks Institution, of which I teach, at the Frederick Douglass Marcus Garvey Academy, Dr. Umar Johnson's school, slated to open Kwanzaa of, I believe, 2024 in Wilmington, Delaware, Nation House in Washington, D.C., Kimoyo Shule Africana in Baltimore, Maryland. Those are the four schools. And then we have two subsidiary organizations that do amazing work, although they're not schools. They are independent African educational institutions, but they're not schools. The first one is How Allies Link All Together, HALA, which is the research institution of which I am a youth organizer, and the Tendaya Family, which is a phenomenal organization doing just incredible, incredible work in Baltimore with the young people of Baltimore. And HALA is also doing incredible work in New York City. And so we also reason that these, you know, it's not a coincidence that these four schools plus two organizations are located in four different cities on the Northeast, because we understand that if a community is a body, right? If say let's liken a community to a human body, then the school is the heart. And if you can unify a school, you can unify a community. And if you can unify four schools, you can unify four communities and thereby augment the work that they are doing individually and lay the foundation for more work to be done. Now, our methodology is based around a guiding question, which is, how can this youth coordinating committee mobilize young students between the ages of 10 to 20, which are the most untapped resource of our community, in order to engage the grassroots African working class, which consists of community organizations, small businesses, and everyday black people, in a protracted campaign to make a meaningful investment into the future of our community? And so let's move on to the implementation of this methodological question. Well, we have a three-pronged outreach strategy. The first prong is cleanup and outreach. We're not beggars. We're coming to the African working class, but we're not coming as beggars. We're coming as organizers. And so we provide cleaning services in the neighborhoods, because I know in New York City, whoever else, if you haven't been to New York City, if you're from there, you know it's one of the most dirtiest cities in the world. And our people, and that's probably one why COVID affected New York City so vehemently, because it's just absolutely filthy in our neighborhoods. You can be on one block where there's a bunch of black people and it's filthy, and go to the next block where it's some other people, some Jewish people, and it's clean. And so we realize that we're not coming as beggars, we're coming as organizers, and we want to provide a service to our people as we engage them. And a petition of 5,000 signatures to prevent state institutions. We also have a speaker series to engage young people. We go into schools. If we can't get into the schools because the administrators are afraid of the message that we're going to give, we stand outside the schools and introduce the young people to their legacy of black liberation. We say that young people are the most important because they have the energy. They don't have the ailments. They don't have the diseases yet. They don't have they have the optimism. They haven't been convinced that black people are these monsters who don't care about themselves, like most of us have been convinced. They have the energy. They have the optimism. They have the time on their hands. They don't have to work 12 and 14 hours a day to pay rent, just to pay rent. They have the time, they have the energy, they have the optimism. What they don't have is the emotional and spiritual connection to their legacy. And that's because they're not being taught it in schools. And so we reason that if we can get in front of these young people and connect them to their legacy, they'll flock to these cadres in droves. We also realize that this is not something that one organization can undertake, which is a good thing. Because remember, strategic goal number 4, we want to build coalition culture. So on two ends, on both ends, we're building coalitions. On one end, we're going to pressure institutions into a mutual aid developmental agenda. Right? What does that mean? It means you're going to write a document on how you're going to mutualize your operations in a 5-year developmental plan, and you're going to present it to your community. That effectively is a united front. That's a coalition. On the other end, in order for us to get that $50,000 from the African working class, we will have had to engage multiple organizations. Multiple organizations are going to have to work together to get that $50,000. Multiple organizations are working together to get that $50,000. And after we get the $50,000, and we present it to the institutions, and we get that mutual aid developmental agenda, what do you think is going to happen to the coalition or the critical mass that it took to get that 50,000? You think it's just going to dissipate? You think it's just going to disappear? No, it's not. It's still going to be there, and we're going to be able to do something else with it. And then we have a cultural program called Youth Fest, which is happening on October the 1st. And so Youth Fest is a place for cultural expression. It's also a platform for young organizers to engage the community with their programs, initiatives, and ideas. You know, a lot of times, you know, us young people, we have analysis that can push the movement forward. And, you know, I'm 24. You know, you haven't seen the brothers and sisters, specifically the sisters, man. You haven't seen or heard these young brothers and sisters, man, these 18-year-olds, these 19-year-olds, these 20-year-olds, these 20, 21, 22, these people who are studying. You haven't heard what they have to say and the analysis of the last 60 years that they have to give. Oh, man. And so we want to give them a platform, a serious platform, where they can be taken serious by the community, which we call Youth Fest. It's also a talent show, and we also use it to let the community know that we are involved in a struggle, to solicit their help, and just to, you know, bond as a community. You know, we I don't know why we take out celebrate. Well, maybe we don't, but celebration is an important part of revolution as well. Celebration, we need to incorporate celebration and recreation
into our revolutionary praxis, just as well as doing the other kinds of work. Those things are important. I know my time is 3:20, so I want to get to the conclusions. So we have a 2023 fundraising schedule. These are some important dates to watch out for. Some of these dates have already happened. So the PAFM, the Pan-African Federalist Movement's Youth Caucus, which was a two-day event, two-day caucus from the 21st to the 22nd, where about 15 organizations from four different cities, Philadelphia, New York City, Baltimore, and Washington, D.C., came together to outline the different ills, or maybe I should say the same ills, that their communities are facing, and sign a resolution resolving the resources, the human resources and otherwise resources, in a mutual aid developmental agenda called the Harlem Resolution of 2023. And if you would like to read that resolution, you can get my email, NESIM, the number one, so NESIM1@morgan.edu, if you'd like to read that resolution and if you'd like to stand in solidarity with these organizations, please, I can send it to you. The Families for Power Initiative, which is a collective economics initiative that we've been running for 5 years. This is how we fund Youth Fest. Last year we raised $2,700 between eight families over a period of 35 weeks. Curb Fest for Political Prisoners. Ashe to Masoud Shakur, Dr. Masoud Shakur's ancestors, my elders, my personal elders, Baba Sanjaka and Baba Sekou Odinga, and the rest of the political prisoners who are currently being held against their will for our interests in the United States prison system and the hypocritical United States government who says that they hold no political prisoners. And so we get together to celebrate that. That's happening on September 16th. It happens in multiple cities. So it's happening in New York City on September 16th. But there's one that happens in Philadelphia. There's one that happens in Baltimore. There's one that happens in Washington, D.C. Those are the ones I'm aware of. I believe there's one that happens in Atlanta. But we also hold it in New York City. So that's happening September 16th. Youth Fest is happening October 1st. We are also bringing Chairman Omali Yashitela of the African People's Socialist Party to New York City on October 24th. Speaker series happened as requested. This is a part of the speaker series. This presentation I'm doing for right now is a part of the speaker series. And we use the speaker series to heighten the awareness of the people to this struggle and also to solicit funds. So if you are listening and would like to be a part of the 5,000 who give $10 to this campaign, you can cash app the campaign at Youth Cleanup. $Youth Cleanup. Youth Cleanup. And the cleanups happen every Saturday. We have been holding down Crown Heights, which is a community in Brooklyn, New York. We have recently expanded into Harlem. We are moving into Harlem. And this is a multi-organizational effort. So there are about 5 to 8 organizations who are working on this project in New York City alone. Our conclusions are that the current times call for the centralization of existing institutions in order to develop the area of our community that lacks substantive infrastructure. Now, the whole world is going crazy. We see what's happening in West Africa. The African Revolution is rearing its head in West Africa. We see the African, the white working class, the cracker working class, is dissatisfied with the cracker working class. The cracker working class is dissatisfied with the cracker bourgeoisie here in the United States. We see the United States going against Russia, going against China and Russia, who I'm not a fan of per se. I don't get it twisted. I'm not endorsing Russia or China. I'm saying that Russia and China are challenging United States hegemony over the world economic system. We see the rise of automation. We see the rise of robotics. Robotics and automation, which is going to force a change in the economic system, which in turn is going to force a change in the social system. We see the millions of jobs disappearing month by month, being taken up by robots. We see the masses of our of the people in this system dissatisfied. The system is going to implode under its own weight. And black people, African people in this country who are at the bottom of the system, will bear the brunt, as it always does. We see racist white supremacist attacks, which seem uncoordinated, but which are actually coordinated. We see African people being targeted, gunned down in supermarkets. We see African people being gunned down in churches. Racist white supremacist crackers with assault rifles gunning our people down in the street and writing manifestos, 100 and 200 page manifestos. The system is imploding, and we must stop thinking dogmatically that the masses of African people do not care about self-determination. This is not true. This is not true. We must stop believing that we have no infrastructure. This is not true.
All right, Brother Nemo, we got about 2 minutes left. 2 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you. The second conclusion, that the development must come from the grassroots working class for it to be truly effective. We cannot go to the corporations. We cannot go to philanthropy. We must go to the people, the African working class, the people themselves, the unconscious revolutionary themselves, with a concrete plan and unshakable resolve. And the third conclusion is that if we are useless, then we are useless and toothless. This endeavor, our development, must be student-led. Young people organized into trained cadres to interface with the grassroots working class African population must be the organizational strategy, the basic organization strategy. And how can you help, listener? How can you help? Well, one, you can sign the petition urging the state organizations to create a developmental mutual aid agenda. Two, you can become one of the 5,000. Give a donation of $10 to help us reach our second strategic goal. Three, spread the word. Give us the space to present this struggle to other organizations in view of building more solidarity. And four, commit to organizing a cleanup outreach cadre that can interface with the community every Saturday. I want to pay homage to Ella Baker. We stand on the shoulders of Ella Baker. We stand on the shoulders of Malcolm X. We stand on the shoulders of Fannie Lou Hamer, these people who have come before us and laid the ground, who suffered and laid the ground for us to suffer proudly today. I want to thank this organization, this radio station, for giving us the opportunity to speak. And I want to thank you, the listening audience, just for being you. I hope that you unite with this struggle. I hope that you force the leadership, you petition the leadership of your organization to unite with the struggle. And I pray for the sovereignty and development of African people worldwide. Thank you. Uhuru.
All right. Thank you, Brother Nemo. That's all we got for this week. I guess I see your hands up, but hey, he got it all out. 24 years old, so our young people are willing, ready, and able. What about you? We'll talk to y'all next week. That's Empowerment Saturday, African-American Empowerment Saturday. 365 days of you know what for you know who. Next week, y'all. Go on, slide on. Oh.
Oh, yeah.